It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today we talk bones, the lost bones, the bizarre bones, and most of all, the luscious bones. Food writer Jennifer McLaughlin says we've become a boneless nation, succumbing to anonymous lumps of protein. Her retaliation? Her book, Bones, Recipes, History, and Lore. Well, the Stearns have unearthed a couple who do one peerless loaf of bread, nothing else, at Connecticut's Wave Hill Baker. Sally Schneider has the Italian shortcut to crispy chicken. You just need a brick and a bird. New York food guy Mike Colomeco tells us of the city's classic seafood restaurants. Then Gourmet's John Willoughby investigates the stovetop that's come from why bother to gotta have. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's Boneless Nation, the backlash. Check out the meat case. There's nary a bone in sight. Well, our guest, food writer Jennifer McLaughlin, bemoans the loss of the bone in all its succulence and social significance. Her book is Bones, Recipes, History, and Lore. That cook's cook, Sally Schneider, has turned weight into an asset for the crispy 25-minute chicken. Gourmet's executive editor, John Willoughby, talks induction cooktops. Worth the money or just another useless gadget? Our New York City food guy, Mike Colomeco, has his top four seafood eateries. And then for you wine-loving folk, great training wheels. Practice for your nose. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's break out with Jane and Michael Stern. They do the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, this is so exciting. Red alert.
I forget
what
it does. Yes.
What do they do when, you know, there's a you know, exciting bulletin coming on? Michael and I have found the ultimate bread bakery, and we just found it 3 days ago, and it's a mile from our house.
So we're in big trouble.
Phenomenally
this does
delicious.
Not bode well.
No,
guys.
But this is definitely do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Red alert, red alert, bread alert.
It's called Wave Hill Breads. It's in Wilton, Connecticut. It's behind Route 7. It's a little inconspicuous storefront place. You can buy the bread there or at a couple of local markets. And what they make is one kind of loaf only.
One?
That's it. That's all they do. It's a three-grain pain de campagna that is so crusty, kind of with that leathery, firm crust and that kind of wonderful, full flavored inside. You know, it's the raising process is like 8 to 10 hours.
Oh,
so it's like it's one of those really great, truly kind of European breads. I mean, it's the kind of bread that I personally could live on.
Well, let me tell you what the Sterns have eaten, I guess breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I'm thinking lunch and dinner for the last 3 days. We bought 2 pounds of Plugra butter, salted and unsalted. We bought a loaf of this bread every single day. We ate bread and butter for lunch, bread and butter for dinner.
I had bread and olives, excuse me.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
I like unsalted butter. Michael likes salty butter. So basically, we have just lived on Wave Hill breads and butter for the last 3 days.
The Mediterranean diet commits
yeah,
suicide.
Right.
Whole
and I lost
bread
50
and
pounds.
Better.
It's amazing.
And you know, the thing is, Lynn, we have so long been on a soapbox about how bread quality has been on the decline so much. I mean, here in Connecticut, where we live, where there are so many great Italian restaurants, try to find a good loaf of Italian bread. Can't be done. Go to New York to the great delis where they have wonderful pastrami, corned beef. Try to find it on a really great slice of sour crusted rye. Can't be done anymore. So finding a great bread like this is a real discovery.
And don't even mention bagels. I mean, you know, bagels, which used to be chewy wonderful, you know, are now big like puff balls.
Yeah, they're like muffins or something.
But who is doing this bread?
There are these two, it's a couple. It's Mitchell Rappaport and Margaret Sapper. And what they did before they baked bread is, I don't know. I don't think they've been in the bread. This is something they started at home, became passionate about it, studied how to do it, and really got it right.
It sounds
I don't think they're restaurateurs. I think they're just passionate bakers.
No, and the way it is now, it's such a small-scale operation. I mean, you go in about noon, and the bread is just coming out of the ovens. When I got it yesterday, it was too hot to put into the bag. They gave it to me atop, you know, and of course I ate it in the car. I actually had to get out of the car to buy my olives on the way home. And I came back to the car, and when I opened the door, the smell of this loaf of bread in my car was dizzyingly good.
So was there any left for Jane when you got home?
I brought home a half a loaf by the time I got it.
I understand.
It's very hearty, so it goes a long way.
I'm picturing you driving and trying to balance an olive on a chunk
and
of
a
bread.
And a hot loaf of bread.
On a hot loaf of bread. Oh, yeah. Okay, so man can live by bread alone as long as he's got
blue with butter.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Thanks.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Goodbye, Lynn.
He likes bread and butter. He likes toast and jam. That's what his baby feeds him. He's a loving man.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Road Food. Now, you can tune into the Sterns right here every week, but you can tune into their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. You know, bread baking, maybe because of all its metaphysical and metaphorical sides, attracts what you could call fanatics. Well, here's a few books by fanatics that I have enjoyed. Now, for the pathologist's dissertation on sourdoughs, go to Dr. Ed Woods. He's researched and isolated bread cultures around the world. Now, each one gives you a different loaf without a packet of yeast. His book is a paperback. It's called Classic Sourdoughs, A Home Baker's Handbook. Artisan bread baker Dan Leader talks flours like few others. He's done bread alone. Peter Reinhardt gives you a master's in bread in his The Bread Baker's Apprentice. And an excellent compendium of loaves is Artisan Baking Across America by Maggie Gleaser. Now, I've put this list up on the website. You know where, guys. SplendidTable.org. Oh, and while you're there, take a look at our upcoming trip. We're heading to Santa Fe. It's a combination of two of my very favorite things. Food and music. You'll find the details, you know, splendidtable.org. Food writer Sally Schneider is a born culinary improviser with a lovely sleight of hand. She comes up with these simple concepts that somehow always have an elegant feel to them. Her book is A New Way to Cook. Hey, Sally, welcome.
Good to be here, Lynn. Thanks.
So what have you been working on, dear?
I have been slaving on a book. Nobody thinks cookbooks are work, but they seriously are, as you know.
Oh, yeah.
But the irony of it is about how do I feed myself when I'm working so hard? And so I wanted to tell you my favorite technique for a quick dinner. This is what I do a lot because I think it is so wonderful and makes such delicious results for so little work. And that is a classic farmhouse, Italian farmhouse dish called chicken al mattone, which I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
Well, in Italy, a chicken, the backbone would be cut out and it would be butterflied and it would be put in a pan and weighted with a heated terracotta brick, basically.
Yeah, it's a big round disc, but it weighs a ton.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it weights the chicken down. It flattens it out so it gets really crisp and it can cook in a frying pan all the way through. Now, I live in an apartment in New York, so I don't have many bricks around, so I do my makeshift version. I take this chicken, I flatten it out, put it in an, I use a nonstick skillet because it ensures it won't stick.
Right.
And then I put another iron skillet on top and I put a weight in that, and that's, you know, however you get it done, that's my makeshift version. And what I end up with is chicken with an incredibly crisp skin, which I love, and succulent inside. Now, I'm doing this over and over, and one day I think, why not do another bird? You know, I've never seen it in cookbooks for some reason, but there are all these great birds around in supermarkets now. So I start on my little experiments. I throw a squab into the pan.
You've got squab in your supermarket, only in New York City. I love
well,
this.
All right, so.
But so anyway, get the idea. So you do the squab.
You do a squab. Suppose you have a poussin or a baby chicken,
right,
or a Cornish hen or a quail or a guinea hen, or I even did a duck. I can't believe I
you
even
did
tried
a duck?
That. Yes.
You know, that's really a great idea, and you're right. I never thought of that, and I was raised with chicken done like this.
Yes, it's the technique that is so brilliant. It needs nothing more than salt and pepper, but if you want to throw herbs in the pan or make a rub or whatever, you can. The squab I marinate in raspberry puree using frozen raspberries, and it gets this incredible mahogany sheen. Guinea hen I cook in bacon fat. I render, you know, a few strips of bacon.
What could
and
be
you
bad?
Can do exactly.
Yeah, it's a-
you know, it, what do you have on hand? Bacon in the freezer? So a chicken with bacon and thyme is fabulous. You can also make great pan sauces because there are all these brown sort of, you know, pan bits in the bottom of the pan. Throw in some white wine. I love Madeira, and then some heavy cream for a very luxurious sauce with, again, no effort.
How long does it take to cook most of these things?
A chicken is about 25 minutes. A game hen, maybe 15. Quail are
4 seconds.
Know, a minute or two yeah, on each side. Yeah, a squab, yeah, which is you want it to be pink, is 5 minutes on each side. It really depends on the size of the bird, and you kind of get the feel of it. You know, I start it skin side up and cook the bottom, the inside first, and then I end it with the skin down so that the skin is the thing that is really crisped at the end.
This, you know, beats the microwave.
I never
thought of it as a fast supper, but as you're talking about it, it makes a lot of sense.
It's about 5 minutes worth of work, and then the rest is in the pan, unattended.
Under brick.
Yes.
It's a Sally technique. Hey,
it
Sally,
is.
Thank
yes.
you.
You're welcome.
Sally Schneider is author of A New Way to Cook. Now, you can find Sally's recipe for crisp fried chicken with rosemary and garlic cloves on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Each week, you get a quick recipe and some shopping and technique tips. And best of all, Weeknight Kitchen is free. So, you know where to go, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the return of bygone bones, the best in New York City seafood, and gourmet skinny on induction cooktops. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too, online at target.com/supertarget. Something to ponder. The state of we the people might be divined in the supermarket meat case. Now, we are all but a boneless nation. Now, we're not spineless. We still have lots of gumption. But check out the meat and the chickens and the fish. Nearly everything is boneless. I mean, the only big cell in bones is the spare rib. Now, those disappearing bones could be the tell of what's really been lost from our lives. Cookbook author Jennifer McLagan has been pondering this loss of the bone. Her new book is Bones, Recipes, History, and Lore. Jennifer, welcome.
Hello, Lynn.
So is the idea behind the book that we have sort of given ourselves up to anonymous lumps of protein, essentially?
Well, yes, I think we've forgotten how good meat tastes on the bone. It's totally disappeared from our lives. So I was trying to reintroduce people to the tastes and flavors that come with cooking on the bone and try to persuade them it's not a difficult thing to do.
You address this issue of bones from an even broader point of view. You talk about how the whole animal is gone from our lives.
Yes, I think we're totally disconnected as to where our food comes from, because all we see are boneless pieces of meat wrapped in plastic wrap in the supermarket, and we forget that they actually come from animals, and we never see the whole animal, and we never understand exactly what we're eating. So I think it's very important, if we're going to kill animals, that we use every part of them. We don't just toss things away that we perceive as lesser cuts or not as good cuts, because actually the price isn't a dictate of how tasty the piece of meat is. I would argue that a beef shank has a lot more flavor than a beef tenderloin.
The leg of the beef.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. People think it's all bones. They think, oh, I just make soup with that, and just the bones themselves. But pieces of meat with the bones still attached to them make a delicious, flavorful stew or braise, because there's all those collagens and gelatin that's in the bone that melts with the heat, and it makes a rich, unctuous sauce that's unmatchable by any other way of cooking.
You know, it makes me think, I wonder if we could go back and look historically at, as societies become more affluent, less and less of the different parts of the animal appear on menus. I wonder if there's some sort of consistency through history of that.
Well, I think there's maybe some post-Second World War kind of syndrome that maybe people were forced during certain times to eat pieces of meat that had bones in them, and they associated them with hard times. And as soon as they had enough money to buy a fillet steak, they thought that was a better piece of meat to eat, and so that's what happened, right?
Well, yeah.
But, you know, a lot of great chefs, like someone like Thomas Keller, they're serving braised short ribs in their restaurant, right? I mean, there is a move back. Lamb shanks have come back into fine-class dining, and people think, oh, that's something really special. I'll order that in a restaurant. But it's such a simple thing to make at home.
You know, I think people think that if the bone is in, it's more work.
Yes, I think that's true. I think that's exactly true. But most of these dishes, once they're cooked, they just fall off the bone. The bone has really done its work by adding flavor and taste.
Absolutely. I'd like to talk about what you think of as the ignored bones. I mean, the bones that are overlooked, but they are in a lot of supermarket meat cases.
Well, I think something like beef rib bones are often overlooked, because there always be boneless steaks. So once they cut them off, there are often bones left. Sometimes you can get a whole rack.
Exactly.
They just have a little bit of meat on them, but it's like, you know, when you do a standing rib roast and you have those bones left, how good they are to chew on. Well, you can often pick them up for really nothing in the supermarket, and you can put a glaze and you can broil them or barbecue them. They're absolutely delicious.
Talk to me about fried fish bones. This is from Japan.
That was kind of a fun recipe. I have a friend who lives out in Seattle who's Japanese, and she's a cooking teacher out there. And I was corresponding with her and getting some ideas. And she sent me this recipe for fried fish bones, which she said is very popular in Japan. And that's interesting, because the Japanese don't have a lot of bones in their food. It tends to be a cuisine without bones.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they take the bones of these very small fish, and I did them with small smelts because I could get those.
Right.
And I took off the flesh, and I had this small bone left, and I just popped it in the deep fryer and deep fried it till it was crispy. And then I had to take a leap of faith to eat the first one, but it was like a crispy, slightly fishy French fry. Absolutely delicious.
Well, you know what you're reminding me of? I'm thinking of ordering in Chinese or Japanese restaurants whole fried flat fish, where you find that those bones around the rim are crunchy and fabulous.
Yes, and the deep frying kind of softens them up or crisps them, and so then you can just crunch them all up and eat them. It's absolutely delicious.
Absolutely fabulous. The other thing you do in the book is you've got all these stories about bones, and I want you to tell, speaking of fish, could you tell the story about the left and the right fish?
Well, what I discovered is that flatfish, like a flounder or a sole, they start off their life like every other fish, like a round fish, like a salmon or a trout, and
right.
they swim vertically, like regular fish, they swim vertically.
Uh-huh.
And at a certain time during their development, some kind of genetic memory triggers in and they flip over. And so then they start swimming like flatfish, right, on one side. And because they're flipped over, one of their eyes actually migrates from one side of their head round to the other side, so they have both of their eyes on the top of their head.
Well, that's
they're not
right.
like
yeah.
in the center of
yeah.
their head where you might expect them to be.
Yeah.
And so certain of these fish are left-handed fish, and some of them are right-handed fish.
You mean they're on the left side of the body or the right side of the body? That
exactly,
their eyes...
exactly.
Yeah, okay.
So I think fish like flounder and plaice and halibut, they're right-handed fish, and the left-handed fish are turbot and brill. But I also read occasionally this genetic mechanism doesn't work quite well, and the fish, he may be a left-handed species, but the eyes will end up on the right-hand side of his head. So when all his friends are swimming in one direction, he's swimming in the other.
Hold
so
on.
I'm not sure if there's any kind of fish psychology going on down there, but it must be kind of stressful.
I'm thinking of two flounders in love, but they can never meet. You never know what you're going to find in a book on bones. Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Jennifer McLaughlin is author of Bones, Recipes, History, and Lore. Now, you have got to try her beer-glazed beef ribs. The recipe's on the website, splendidtable.org. Call me madcap. But I'm one of those people that no matter how much evidence that you can show me that the seafood I get in Chicago is as fresh as the seafood in Boston, I feel better about eating seafood in a place where I can actually see the ocean. Which brings me to my old hometown, New York City. Now, there is one man who knows that town like no other. He's Mike Colomeco. He covers the city for his PBS 13 food show called Mike Colomeco's Food Show. Hey, Mike, welcome back.
Always great.
So, Mike, where do you think are the classic places to eat seafood in the city?
Well, I want to start at the beginning. New York's always had these great seafood towns because we're on the water. Long Island's, you know, across the East River.
Mm-hmm.
The boats in and out of the harbor. At one point, Brooklyn had a big fishery. Sheepshead Bay was named after a fish called the sheepshead. But it still does. But there were certain old-style genre seafood restaurants that existed until 1987, when a place called Bernardin opened. And you know it. Maybe it's one of the most famous seafood restaurants in the country, but for good reason. I was here cooking as a chef when Bernardin opened, and it was really the opening of the year. Everybody knew Gilbert Lacoste was coming from France with his sister. They knew they had two stars at Michelin in Paris. But what they didn't know was these guys were going to revolutionize the way Americans bought, cooked, and looked at seafood. This was the first restaurant in America that ever said, "How would you like your salmon cooked?" Hadn't been uttered before. Wasn't a choice. You got seafood cooked the way it was cooked, which was basically well done. This was the first place to suggest that there was another way to do it, and hence the very first medium-rare salmon served. This was the restaurant where tuna tartare was invented, where salmon carpaccio had its debut. You know, dishes that are now ubiquitous around the country
yeah.
actually got their start there. And I don't think, you know, it's hard to connect the dots sometimes with culinary trends, but you really can't overplay how important this restaurant has been. It's still going strong. They just got, you know, Michelin just came to New York like we needed them. But it just got three Michelin stars to add to its New York Times 4 stars, which it's had since they first opened. It's an astonishing place, albeit very pricey. But if you're looking for gold standard and it's an occasion and you're in New York for, you know, something big, that's a place I just can't recommend enough. It's really the most important seafood restaurant in the country. Another place I love, a few blocks to the east of that, is a place called Oceana. They've got a young chef there, young, 34, you know, a kid.
A kid, a baby,
for crying out loud. I'd card him if I was a bartender. Cornelius Gallagher, he's wonderful. It's a small room. He lot of modern preparation. He's got a great resume. He worked with great Kunz at L'Espinasse, worked at the original Boulez, spent a couple of years working overseas, both in Spain and France, and just has a real deft touch with seafood. He is great. I had a great meal there last night. He understands fish. The proteins are really fresh, and he, you know, doesn't let his creativity get in the way. And that's, I think, one of the important things with cooking fish is if it's fresh, it's great. Just present it as straight as you can.
Leave it alone. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
And maybe the best example of that is Dave Pasternak over at Esca, who's a Long Island born and bred guy, a crazy sport fisherman. When he's not in the restaurant cooking, either he's out on a boat or he's surf fishing. He's an absolute nut about seafood, knows what's running. And I hang out with him, and I'll be with him, and his cell phone will ring, and there'll be some guy, you know, 25 miles off the coast of Montauk with a load of tuna, and he buys it. and his restaurant
pull
is
the
just,
boat up to the restaurant.
Basically, that's right. I mean, I've seen it. He pulls in his SUV and, you know, unhooks those big thermos things in the back, and he's got fish that he caught the day before fishing, just iced down. He's a lunatic, but his restaurant, I mean, it's almost the kind of place you want to go with 10 people so you can eat half the menu. Everything is great. It's not terribly expensive. Wonderful, wonderful food. Really, probably one of the top three or four places in the city in my book. I just love the guy.
So that's Esca.
That's Esca, yep.
Any place for, you know, I don't want to sit down and have a dinner and I don't want to spend, you know, a lot of money.
Perfect. Rebecca Charles, really interesting story, summered in the coast of Maine as a child and wanted to replicate those memories, those flavors. She opened up a place in the village on Cornelia Street, which is this little tiny two-block street that basically connects, you know, one little street to another. It's one way. It's great. She opened up Pearl Oyster Bar, named after her grandma, and really just to recreate this, you know, seaside dining thing with piles of fries, lobster rolls. Her seafood's great. Very almost like Pasternak Redux, very simple, straightforward. Mm-hmm. Piece of seafood, vegetable, fries on the plate, everything's house-made, everything's wonderful. And she's probably most famous for her lobster roll, which is this, you know, beautiful, bound, warmed lobster salad in a, basically, a Pepperidge Farm hot dog roll sautéed in butter that once you've had it, you dream of it afterwards.
And it melts away.
It melts away. And these sort of lobster shacks have become popular around town, and she's really the first one. She's the one that did it years back, and it's great. I love her. She's a hoot. And you can eat at the bar. It's a tiny space. It's typical Greenwich Village. You know, the tables are about 8 inches by 9 inches. You cannot put your elbows on them, or they'll flip over, or you eat at the bar. But it's a wonderful spot, and she's a hoot.
Mike, you filled the bill. Thank you.
Hey, Lynn, thanks. As always, thanks an awful lot.
You can see Mike Colomeco on Mike Colomeco's Food Show on New York's PBS 13. And you can find Mike's New York seafood restaurant picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Sean Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine and an award-winning food writer. Now, this means he's constantly checking out food scenes around the globe and pondering what is happening in our own home kitchens. Well, he comes by regularly to talk about what's engaging him at the moment. John, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
John, Gourmet recently did a piece on induction cooktops. Can you explain?
Yes,
we did. Explain what this is.
Well, it's called magnetic induction, and it's kind of magic. What happens is you have an electrical coil inside a cooktop, and it produces a high-frequency magnetic field. And then if you have a pot that has any iron or steel in it, it will cause the molecules of iron and steel to move back and forth really fast, creating a lot of friction, so the pot gets really hot. But the stovetop itself and everything else stays completely cool. So you can be boiling something, you take the pot off, and you put your hand on the stovetop, and it's cool. It's very strange. And when someone suggested that we do an article on this technology, I was very skeptical because I'm skeptical about new technology. I like flame. I like cooking with flame.
Yes,
and
yes, you're the
grill
guy.
And I remember that 20 years ago this was going to be the next big thing, and it just didn't work very well, and you needed special pots, and it just really seemed like it was not worth investigating. But I have become convinced that it really is a good thing.
Well, to me, the real there are several real tests for a stovetop. And one is, does it get hot enough fast enough? And the other is, how fast does it, how low does it go? Because these are the two extremes you need, really hot, really low. And how fast can that happen?
Right. And those were the things that I was curious about, too. So what I did was I asked our most skeptical test cook to go to the showroom of one of these companies that manufactures them and try it out. And she was, like me, thought it was going to be just a waste of time. But in fact, it has ultra high power, it has ultra low power, and it goes instantly from one to the other. What she ended up saying, which is a little poetic but seems right, she said, this is so responsive and it such has such extremes of high and low that it's like dancing a tango with a partner working with this stove.
Wow.
She ended up loving it because it produces the equivalent of about 30,000 BTUs at its high point. And the highest you can get on a home stove, even one of these supposedly, you know, the professional home stove, is 18,000 BTUs. So it gets very, very hot. And she said, and I watched it, as soon as you turn it on, it reaches that heat. So you can boil water in about a third of the time, for example, that you need on even the most high-powered of the home gas stoves.
Huh.
And she turned it all the way down, and this was a great test. She took a chocolate chip and put it on inside the pot that was on very low,
right.
And we let it sit there, and nothing happened. But she said, okay, now take a spoon and touch it. And I touched it, and it was melted. But it was just sitting there in that shape. And she said you could leave it. She left a hollandaise sauce on the low temperature for an hour. It was fine. It's almost like a warming oven. And it really does go instantly from one back to the other. So you might not want to have all this be the only thing that you have in your kitchen because it's, you know, it's new. It might still have some bugs. But
right.
It really seemed to work really well. And you could sear steaks really fast. You could boil water really fast. And you could keep things warm without scorching them. It really didn't seem to have a lot of drawbacks to it.
Huh. Well, you know, big question. How much does it cost?
It's not real cheap, but now they just recently started manufacturing them in the U.S. So you can get a 30-inch cooktop from Sears as the new manufacturer for $1,600. And I think what a lot of people might do, what I think I'm going to do, is you can actually buy a single burner unit that you can put on your counter next to your regular stove.
So you can just plug them in?
Yep, for $600, which, you know, is not nothing, but, you know, if compared to what it can do, it's really worth it. The one thing is you have to have, it takes the same wiring as an electric oven, so you have to have that wiring available.
Well, you know, I'm thinking of that great quote from Thoreau, beware of all enterprises that require new clothes. Now, I've always heard you need special cookware, that I've got to check
yes.
my cookware and go out and buy something brand new to work with this
yes.
induction.
That was what I had heard, too, and it turns out not to be true. I think 20 or 30 years ago, when people first started talking about it, there wasn't so much stainless steel cookware around. If you have stainless steel or cast iron, anything that has iron or steel in it will work. And to find out, you just take a little refrigerator magnet. If it sticks to the pan, then you can use the pan. So we went around our 8 test kitchens, and 95% of what we have there works. So you really don't, I mean, you might need to buy one new pot because you might not have a frying pan, for example, that works or whatever. But most cookware in most kitchens will work.
Huh. Hey, John, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine. The article on induction cooktops is in the February issue. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, this one comes from the cookbook we talked about earlier, Jennifer McLaughlin's Bones. The question is about an old belief of many fishermen. Here it is. What two things would a fisherman never do while eating a fish? Then we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment, but first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. It comes from the book Bones, and the question is about an old belief of many fishermen. The question was, what two things would a fisherman never do while eating a fish? Well, superstitious though it may be, a fisherman evidently would never eat a fish from head to tail. The lore was that if you ate it from head to tail, this would sweep the school of fish away from the fisherman's boat. Also, he'd always start eating at the tail. Now, that would drive the fish toward his boat. Second, he'd never flip the fish over while eating it. This symbolized capsizing the boat. Better safe than sorry. It's time for your calls, brought to you by Muir Glen Organic Tomatoes. Tomatoes true to nature. Okay, pick up that phone, guys. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. And we will talk. Let's get right to it. We have Claire calling from Upland, Kansas. Hey, Claire, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. First of all, I want to tell you that my 11-year-old granddaughter loves your program so much.
Oh, thank you.
She has your number on her speed dial.
I love that.
Isn't that great?
We haven't heard from her. Tell her to call us. We'd love to talk to her.
Well, I have a call. I have a fond holiday memory that I haven't been able to reproduce for years. My mother used to have me go down to the root cellar and get a can of pickled peaches.
Oh.
They were made by S&W or Libby, and we would have them around roast pork or around ham.
Oh, Lord. This is such an old concept, isn't it?
No, they really weren't like pickles.
Mm-hmm.
They were more like spiced, but they were called pickled peaches.
Right.
Do you know who might make them or how I could reproduce them?
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. You know, I think I'd go to go on the web, but I'm trying to think where to be. Oh, well, I can tell you one reference. Lee Bailey.
Okay.
Yeah, the name, Leebaily. His recipe books are fabulous, and I know he's got to have a pickled peach recipe. And I'm just trying to think, because some of the great jam makers might also be doing this, like, I'm not sure, but June Taylor Jams might be a source. And, I know a place to try. Hoppin' John Martin Taylor. He has a line. He's from South Carolina. He does a line of chutneys and jams and conserves. He might have pickled peaches. And if he doesn't, he's going to have a recipe in one of his cookbooks. It's John Martin Taylor. He's called Hoppin' John.
Oh, that's terrific.
And his stuff is unbelievably good. Because this is, you know, it's most associated with the Old South.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two ways that you did it. One was that you cooked the peaches in a mixture of sugar and vinegar. And the balance between the two would vary according to the recipe and spice.
Okay.
And then preserved it in that. The other thing was that you'd have the raw peaches that you peeled and you'd pour a mixture of the vinegar and the sugar and lots of spices over it in a sterilized jar. And you just let it sit and absorb that.
Okay, that's probably that. I think you're on the right track with that.
Yeah, and
that's
with S&W,
like.
Yeah, a canning company would have actually canned it to make it, you know, to
it
steam
was a commercial
it.
Can.
Right, right. You know, S&W still exists.
Mm-hmm, but they don't. Well,
have you checked them out?
Find it. Actually, I haven't tried them. I've tried all the stores that carry their products.
You know what?
Okay,
go on the net. Go on the net and check S&W. They may not be selling it in your area, but they still may be producing it and selling it somewhere else.
Wonderful.
Yeah, see what you can find. Oh,
thank
boy.
You.
You know, that boy, you brought back memories. I remember
Aww.
Pickled peaches. So Uh-oh. Good.
I yeah. know. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Claire.
Good.
Thanks for calling.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see who's up next. We have got Rebecca calling from Nashville. Hey, Rebecca, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Hi, Lynn. First of all, I just wanted to say I love your show.
Hey, thanks.
I was wondering, I've been a vegetarian for 2 years now.
Uh-huh.
And I live in Tennessee, and I've been having some difficulty with finding a variety of foods. I love food, and I love variety of spices and everything, and it just seems like it's always wasted on the meat eaters. So I was going to see if you had any suggestions.
I must say, you know, you are in prime pork country, which you probably know very well.
Oh, I know.
So what? No, wait. What is the question then?
I just want some ideas for vegetarian cooking, basically.
Okay. Can you find a variety of vegetables? Because I would imagine one of the things you can get in prime shape are fabulous greens.
Yeah.
And the whole cabbage family, and I would imagine the squash family, too.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that comes to mind, I'm noticing as books come in, you know, and come in all through the fall, I think we've got the year of the sweet squash going.
Because, really?
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting. So many cookbook authors have been putting into print really interesting sweet squash recipes. I'm thinking of some of the things that Joan Nathan put in her book, New American Cooking. And there's a wonderful vegetable cookbook that's come out by Barbara Kafka called Vegetable Love. 750 recipes, can you believe?
Wow.
But here's my point. I'm the vegetable stew crazy person. I mean, I could live on them. I make a vegetable stew at least once a week that then we reheat, we change, we mix it with barley, you know, we eat it with rice because we just love it. But the basic thing I think you want to do is think about a combination. Like, for instance, if you dice up sweet squash like butternut or something like that, and you brown that with lots of onion, okay, and some garlic, and then you chop up something like Swiss chard or, you know, rainbow chard, and you add that to the pot along with spices. Now, I love to use, just for an instance, okay, sweet paprika, allspice, cumin, and coriander. And I just saute that in. Now I've got my greens, which are really luscious and kind of, you know, that leafy green flavor, but with an undertone of sweetness. And
right.
I've got the sweet squash. You could also throw turnip greens in there, which have a nice snap to them because they contrast. And you've got that caramelized sweet squash. And then what you do is you can throw some vegetable broth or water. I always, there's a little trick I use because I just think it punches up flavor. And you never taste it at the end of the dish. When I'm done browning or sautéing and I get the herbs and the flavorings really aromatic, I put in like a quarter to a third of a cup of vinegar.
Really?
Yeah, and the reason why I do that is, and I do this with green beans, I do this with cabbage, I do it with just about everything, is that I can scrape up all the brown bits at the bottom of the pan as that boils down. I boil it down to absolutely nothing, but it seems to perk up flavor.
Wow.
Especially if I'm not using like a meat broth or a strong vegetable broth, because the next step is to add liquid of some kind and let those things cook until they're fairly tender. But my idea is you could do the same thing I'm doing with green beans, okay, and cabbage.
Okay.
You could do it with the squash, as I mentioned. You could do it with sweet potatoes. Imagine turnip greens or collard greens with sweet potatoes, browned. That's a fabulous, yeah, and you could throw in some tomato, you know, and you could add whatever seasonings please you. I would fool around with Indian flavors in that, you know, because I think that just would be wonderful with a curry paste.
Right.
Wouldn't that be
right.
fabulous? Is this the kind of thing you're looking for?
That's exactly what I was looking for. It just seems, especially in the South, everything is just cooked with meat in it. You know, it's
tradition.
With a side of meat.
Yeah, I know, and it is a tradition, but you can now do vegetables with a side of vegetables.
Right.
The other thing is that I like the greeny tasting things with the cabbagey tasting things, or the sweet base, the carrot, the sweet squash, the sweet potato, etc., played against the bitter. You know, like a head of escarole, if you can find it. So that you get and you make these braised dishes and they reheat well and they're wonderful. You put them over cooked barley, died and gone to heaven. You know, just fabulous. Or over cornmeal mush. That's called polenta in some parts of the world. Yeah. So I think that's just one basic way to hit it.
Okay.
Hey, enjoy.
Oh, thank you very much. I intend to.
Thanks for the kind words.
Thanks.
Bye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252.
And guys, think about this. The vegetable stew where you don't need the meat, and it ends up that that becomes what you serve in the center of the plate. And then there's, a little bit of the cooked fish or whatever you want on the side of the dish. But that stew is so interesting and it's so substantial that that becomes dinner. And when it's cold out, oh, it's fabulous, just wonderful. Okay, let's see who's up next. We have got Kathy calling from Redmond, Washington. Kathy, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I would like to talk about slow roasting meat.
Ooh, what a perfect time of year for it, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Last December, Sunset Magazine ran a special on the slow food movement, and they reprinted some of Paula Wolfert's recipes, including this incredible recipe for a slow roasted pork shoulder.
Oh, if it's one of Paula's recipes, it's always incredible. That woman is unbelievable.
Yes. And you cooked it for 24 hours. And it just melted. It was amazing. And they had tips for how to do it safely and everything.
Right, right.
So I would like to know, what other cuts of meat can I do this with, and how do I do it safely?
Oh, it's interesting you say that, because last Christmas we talked to Nigella Lawson, the cook and writer from England, and she had, too, for a holiday lunch, a slow-roasted pork shoulder. And I think hers was real short. It was only 7 hours. But the point is, this is the deal. First of all, the shoulder is probably, but for my money, the most flavorful part of any animal. And it because it's not the tenderest cut, it benefits from slow cooking. Now, here's my bet. I think you could slow roast the shoulder of anything in that manner. Now, slow roasting, how big was the cut for Paula's recipe?
Oh, I don't remember the pound. I mean, it was
7 or 8 pounds, maybe?
Yeah, I think so.
Because the real thing here is, if it's a little shoulder from a tiny, tiny little lamb, it's not going to, over 24 hours, it's going to turn to shreds. But if it's, if it's about the size of what your original recipe was, let's say 7 or 8 pounds, and it was bone in, yeah, I think you could do that recipe. You could check our website, splendidtable.org, for Nigella's recipe, because the whole concept there is slow, moderate heat and allowing all the connective material to break down very gradually without losing a lot of moisture, so that everything almost becomes creamy in the process. And you can do this with any cut of meat that has great marbling and lots of, really strong connective tissue. Here, that is also known as a little on the tough side. So you could do this with lamb shoulder. You could do it with a cut of chuck, and the chuck is the beef shoulder. Obviously a whole beef shoulder is a lot more than 7 or 8 pounds. You could do this with veal. So I'd say, you could even do it with game. If you wanted to use game. So I would say go for it. And with lamb, it should be unbelievable. Unbelievable. So give it a shot.
Great. Thank you very much.
You are welcome. You take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye. I've got a basic theory at this time of year. When in doubt, when you're entertaining, you take a chewy protein, a big hunk of chewy protein, okay? And you put it in the, you put lots of spices on it, you put it in the oven, you cover it, slow cook, 300 degrees, give it 5-6 hours. You can reheat it. It's going to be fabulous. It's got to be fabulous. And it's almost work-free, and you don't have to worry, is it rare? Is it well done? All that business. Well, talk about esoteric and fun. I have come across one of the more unusual concepts for the wine types, from the rookies to the connoisseurs. Think about buying them a nose. That is, a scent kit to train the nose to identify wines. Now, this is literally called the nose of wine, and these kits are the brainchildren of a company called Making Sense of Wine. Now, we have their vice president of sales and marketing on the phone, Sebastian Gavillier. Sebastian, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, Sebastian, could you explain the kits, what they actually do?
Well, as you know, the nose is one of our most developed sense, and if you do not train your nose, it becomes lazy. So what Jean Lenoir did, Jean Lenoir is the developer of Le Nez du Vin, Make Sense of Wine. He has created a way to collect the molecular structure of the wine and put them in vials. Now what he did is he labeled each of these molecular structures with the aroma that we can most closely recognize that scent to. So in a nutshell, basically, he came up with a master kit which has 54 aromas. And each of these aromas are found in different types of wines. And once you help your nose develop that your olfactory memory. You can recognize the wines, and you can know what type of grapes it's used. You can know what type of wine it is, and you could even narrow it down to the vintage of the wine, because certain characteristics only occur in specific years.
I've seen these kits. They're very intriguing because they're very attractively boxed, and they're small individual jars with screw tops, each one labeled with the scent it is. And now, is this idea, though, to train the nose to actually help us learn what the characteristics are of a specific grape, or is it broader than that?
Well, it is to train the nose. What often happens is you taste something, you know what it is, but you can't exactly determine it because you don't have the item in front of you. If you eat a banana, for example, and you're holding it in your hand, mm-hmm. you know it's a banana. But if I give you, for example, a juice and I don't tell you what it is, you know what it is inside your head, but you can't narrow it down or
right,
pinpoint it
right.
down. So essentially what this kit does, it helps you develop that olfactory memory and helps you put things together. So it helps you put the aroma and the image together. And then when you go further in your wine studies, it helps you, you know, recognize different aromas in wine, and also which then can tell you what type of grapes were used, what type of wine it is, if it's a good wine, if it's a bad wine, because we also have a false kit. So
yeah, the false kit fascinates me. I'm looking at the list of things that are in it. This is a kit of 12 aromas, 12 little vials, and there are things like horse, moldy earth, rotten apple, rotten egg, sulfur. How attractive to sit there and just keep sniffing all of these things.
It's pretty horrible, but, you know, they say approximately 8% of all wine bottles are faulty, uh-huh. yet less than 1% is reported in the industry. That's because people do not know the faults in wine, and that is probably one of the reasons why a lot of wine stores do not want to carry the faults kit, because they don't want customer coming back with bad bottles. But it is the most used kit. Used by sommeliers, master sommeliers, by a school of enology such as UC Davis. They use it in their program to train their students.
Fascinating, just fascinating. Sebastian, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Sebastian Gavalet is Vice President of Sales and Marketing for Making Sense of Wine. Now, you can find information on their scent kits on the website, splendidtable.org. That's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this quote from the Greek philosopher Diogenes the Cynic. He said, "I like best the wine drunk at the cost of others." Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. Register for it online, splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is brought to you in part by Muir Glen Organic Tomatoes, sun-sweetened, picked in late summer, and canned the same day to preserve their fresh, vine-ripened flavor. Recipes online at muirglen.com. Muir Glen Tomatoes, true to nature. Additional support comes from gather.com, where you can read recipes and helpful hints from the Splendid Table. You can share your perspective at gather.com, online at gather.com. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell with Janelle Sorensen. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham, Julia Schrankler, and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.